So there has been considerably increased governmental action in the OVC area in the last 5 years. The National Plans of Action, OVC frameworks, and of course the funding flows that have been coming into the area of AIDS have also picked up more on the OVC issues than in initial rounds of global fund funding or World Bank or very initial PEPFAR. So there is more activity going on, and I think that prompts an interest in activism or in advocacy. Without further ado, then, I would like to just ask each of our participants to say in a couple of minutes what their work is relevant to this and how they see the complementarity of government and civil society action. And I would like to start with the Honorable Minister from Lesotho.
He's putting me in a spot.
Not at all.
As a Minister of Health and Social Welfare, I see my role clearly as a protector of children, as a voice of the children. It had to take HIV and AIDS to expose the fact that our children were so unprotected, because whether there were few children were being orphaned and were being abused, that went really unnoticed. But it had to take this scourge to expose a lot of us as having been very inadequate in our roles as the voice, as the protectors of children, as the decision maker, as policy makers. So I see my role as the Minister of Health and as a mother as the one who will speak on behalf of the children even when it is really very tough. I'll give you an example. When everybody said, well, you know what, you shouldn't be testing every woman who is pregnant without actually counseling them properly. Well, we passed a law. We are testing every woman who's pregnant. We are looking for them. We are testing them. Because I believe we are also helping them in a way. The epidemic where I come from is 23%. It is such an emergency that people are no longer able to bury people who are their loved ones when they die. And that is very un-African. African people bury people. If you have come to a point where you have mortuaries full, then you know there's something that you're not doing right. And there are so many children also who are dying. So indeed, I am violating people's civil rights and not their human rights. I want to make absolutely sure that all children born, that protect children are protected. Born from now, you know, since we have passed that law, now we are testing also children at 6 weeks. Fortunately, our under fives clinic for, you know, vaccination clinics, the rate is very high. It is in the 90%. Therefore, we feel that we are in a position to get at least 80% of the children and test them who have been born. If we have missed the mother, then we'll catch them at 6 weeks and test them. Therefore, I really, honest and truly believe that a lot of governments, not only in Africa, have been exposed as have been terribly doing not a very good job in protecting the lives of the children. And it took this to know that we are not the law, and a lot of countries, I think, in Africa now are passing laws or that are protecting children, who are orphaned, even though they are and children who are really positive. As a result of that, we are moving forward, and hopefully, beyond HIV and AIDS, we will have a better society.
Thank you very much. And I think this is really an exchange, so we don't need to be applauded each time, unless people are very moved by a particular point.
People were moved.
Okay, good. Then go ahead. Great. Great. Maxwell, could you give us 2 minutes from your point of view about your organization and the complementarity?
Yes, before I say that, maybe I should say that... okay. I must say that I'm happy with the admission of the minister that, you know, they have failed as governments, they have failed greatly in providing services to the children. That is true. It's really sad that we are discussing this at a time when we have enjoyed a period, a long period of where government have actually ratified convention, different conventions, and we have also seen a process where lots of resources have been channeled through different governments to service the children. But what has been happening in different countries is that there's a lot of diversion of resources to other services other than the intention of those resources. So this is quite impressive that a minister could agree that somehow they have failed short in terms of providing or meeting the needs of the children. As an organization, Eye of the Child, we are doing our activities for advocacy. We also provide legal protection, and we also conduct a series of trainings. So through advocacy, perhaps maybe that's where we engage the government most. We strongly believe that government is a primary service provider, and the process to provide services, the first thing the government has to do is to put in place policies and programs, and at the same time, find resources to service those programs and services. As a civil society organization, apart from pushing the government to put those services in place, we also have an extra responsibility to encourage or to mobilize the target audience to patronize and enjoy those services. Somehow we have also failed. We usually, apart from demanding the government to provide the services and also put in place programs, we have also relaxed in a way that we also would expect the same government to mobilize the target audience, let's say the children and their parents, to patronize those services which the government has put in place. So as a civil society organization, we have that extra responsibility, apart from monitoring the role of the government in putting in place the programs and policies, and also finding resources to finance those program and policies, we also have another responsibility to ensure that, you know, the target audience indeed enjoy or patronize the services.
Thank you, Maxwell. I see we're going to have a nice, lively discussion here. Dr. Kibuneka, you could have a couple of minutes, your work and the complementary.
Thank you, Peter. My name is Andrew Kibuneka. I work with the AIDS Support Organization in Uganda. My name is Andrew Kibuneka. I'm a pediatrician working with the AIDS Support Organization in Kampala, Uganda. And also, I do, for the last about 1.5 years, 2 years, I've been doing work with a joint learning initiative on children and HIV/AIDS, Learning Group 3. Just as a background, TASO is a large NGO in Uganda that takes care of both adults and children. We take care of about 4,000 children who are HIV infected, but we also take care of children who are affected by HIV through a lot of issues, psychosocial issues, as well as medical issues. I just wanted also to comment that regarding the issue of the role of the NGOs and governments, I see what has developed over the years is the need for a partnership between the NGOs and the government, a public-private partnership, because as you realize that the issues of HIV AIDS are very complex, and no one single person or method can overcome this important crisis. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. I think we've heard a couple of contrasting or complementary points of view among the NGOs. Brendan Howland, as a parliamentarian, how about yourself?
Peter, so this was a talk show format, a talk show format without the musical interlude, so we have to be entertaining as well, I suppose. I'm happy to actually get the opportunity to speak last after the minister gave a governmental perspective, and I have been a minister for health, so I understand the executive's point of view and the NGOs. And it's interesting to me as a parliamentarian that nobody so far has mentioned parliament, that they assume that there is government and there is NGOs. And that actual democratic tier that exists with legitimacy has been mentioned by nobody. In many of our countries, in fact, most of our countries, the people elect parliament, and parliament elects government. And policy is determined, or should be determined, by parliament, not by the executive. And from my perspective, one of the great deficiencies of the last few days around here has been the centrality of parliament, and therefore the centrality of a democratic accountable forum. Let me, in two or three sentences, say who I am. I obviously am a member of parliament in Ireland, but I also have another hat as vice president of the Association of Parliamentarians for Africa, European Parliamentarians for Africa. Within the advocacy group, obviously I have a responsibility to be accountable to my own electorate in relation to children, and I'd be very happy at length to talk to you about that, because I'm working on a parliamentary commission right now on amending our constitution to provide children's rights. And what looked like a very simple proposition has become an immeasurably complex one. That's for another day. The African work we do is, I suppose, twofold. One, to keep the issue of Africa on European agendas. And secondly, to ensure that we can assist in empowering Parliament and ensuring that Parliaments are skilled, upskilled, and have the resources to effectively do their job, which, as I said in the beginning, is both holding their executives to account and determining policy. My final comment in this opening session will be this. One of the main projects currently underway, and there are many by AWEPA, my organization, is to reconnect Parliament at donor level and recipient level. Because, and it's interesting, I attended a parliamentary forum at lunchtime today under the auspices of the Interparliamentary Union and the Senate of Mexico. And the Vietnamese delegate there said the same point, that money is donated. It goes into the central government maw, but neither the parliament that votes the money in the home state or the parliament of the country that receives the money is connected to know, well, how much and for what is voted, and how is it spent, and is it spent efficiently. And it's making that connection as one of our objectives in the medium term. Thank you.
Thanks very much. You're welcome. Okay. It's very good. I wanted to...
Clap?
Yes, go ahead, please. I think that's actually a very fresh and refreshing perspective that indeed we haven't heard very much at the conferences here, is one from parliaments. I wanted to start off the freer forum debate with a question to the minister. I noticed that she spoke primarily about government and quite frankly, I think, about government's intentions, but didn't speak about the complementarity of civil society and government. Now, you've worked for a civil society organization before being minister. How would you, in your mind, compare the two experiences, and how do they interrelate? And this, yeah, go ahead.
I thought Maxwell spoke very well, really, for civil society. I mean, basically, they are the advocates of the, you know, the children, the voiceless. They push the government to do the right thing. And the role of civil society is key. It's really key. I know when we had, first when Global Fund came, and people were applying for Global Fund, it was very uncomfortable for a number of governments to find themselves having to be, you know, under the watchdog of the civil society and partners and everyone. But that synergy, it worked very, very well. It's working very well. Everybody is accountable in my country, including the civil society. They also, although now there is another angle, they want to be the recipients of the money and be able to disburse it. Well, we're still working on that, but I think that is quite doable. I see the role of civil society as very, very important. They reach, sometimes they are sometimes the implementers on behalf of the government. In my country, that is quite possible. They reach certain sectors of society that we are not able to reach. For instance, they can reach the gay community very easily. They are able to reach sex workers. They are able to reach children, street workers, or children who are very difficult to actually access. So we rely very closely. We have a partnership with civil society. We actually disperse our funding through them. Sometimes they are the implementers, or they implement on behalf of the government, not only donor funding, but also money coming from the budget of the government. So I work well with civil society.
Very good.
And by the way, I am a parliamentarian too, but I'm I'm in the Senate, in the upper house.
We try to get multifunctional participation.
That means I'm not elected.
But let me press you a little further. Are there types of advocacy that you find very useful and some that you find less useful? What would you like to, what would be most useful in terms of a civil society approach to government?
You know, coming from a country that is very small, you know, we have a population of 1.8 million. Yeah, civil society sometimes is seen as a nuisance, I must say. Because they sort of expose things, even though you're still going to get to them, you know, they will expose you. I mean, there is no one way of dealing with civil society, because you don't determine their program. They do what they want to do. Yes, I mean, the best way to do is to plan with them. You know, I've realized that I'm not going to let them off the hook. Global Fund has taught me one or two things. You need to plan with them. When there is budget time, yes, we plan together. We plan. It's not perfect, because you can't have everyone. You know, even with civil society, we have very good organizations. You have organizations that are not so good, and that are, well, you realize you've been given the money and they are receiving even more money from elsewhere. So they need to be as transparent as we are when we are there dealing with us. They expect us to be transparent. They ought to be also transparent. And there are governments that really prefer to deal only with civil society. And for the funding that they receive, I think they need to tell the government of Lesotho what they are getting and what for. And whether they're actually spending the money well, that is also very, very important. But the one thing that I don't like about civil society, you know, even when you're still working on the problem, trying to get to it, they make so much noise. You know, I mean, yeah, it can be very difficult when you're dealing with many issues, because what is good about civil society? One person who's dealing with the issues of children is dealing with the issues of children only and will deal with them. For the elderly, again, you know, you have other people. But you have so much to you know, there's poverty, everything. Right now, we are dealing with the prices of food, and food for people who are on ARVs. That is very difficult, and you know, again, civil society is doing a great job.
Maxwell, I think the minister is making this really very easy for you. if the NGOs, or let's take the idea of the three ones. We know that there should be one national plan. There should be one monitoring and evaluation plan. There should basically be one push for fighting AIDS. And the government is, in part, anyway, in large part, the coordinator of that. How do you relate to that? Are you part of that action, or are you outside simply criticizing it?
And be honest.
maybe on the basis of our experience in Malawi, somehow, because of the economic situation, political situation, we have noticed that the interest of the government might not be on the children as such, or maybe the priority might not be to put in place a program of action or policy, neither a monitoring strategy. So what the NGO will usually do will come together and help invite the government on board. The NGOs become the facilitators of the process, and the government still have the ownership, but the NGOs will take the leadership in terms of facilitating the entire process. So that has actually made things easier for us. And even to the extent that still would work together with the government, but it doesn't mean that we cannot check on the government responsibility. We have in Follas, when we're planning together, and we notice that somehow our program has been delayed because the minister did not come to open our session, or maybe someone else, the principal secretary, did not do ABCD. So we have gone ahead and reminded the minister that you have reasonable responsibility. Otherwise, if you don't do that, then the whole process will be dragged. So we usually rely on a good relationship between the government and the existing good relationship between the government and civil society organization. So NGO can also become the facilitator. Apart from becoming watchdogs, they can also become a facilitator of a process.
in some ways, I think, in the opening.
I wanted to make a comment on the parliament. Why is it that we didn't mention about the parliament? You know, when we're doing an advocacy, when we come up with an advocacy strategy, usually we analyze our partners. And what has been happening, like in my country, and I think in the region, where the government has been led by a minority, usually when we are pushing for a policy or a program for the interest of the children, that is usually not an interest for those who are in the majority, let's say for instance, the opposition. So somehow, the laws has been delayed. The process has been delayed because there's some argument between the minority government and the opposition majority. And usually the argument is along political issues. So what we have done, we have re-strategized. If we are not working directly with the individuals within the ministry, we have now used the court to engage the court in strategic litigation. So somehow the government has been made to dance to respond to the orders made by the court. So we are now trying to address the new development in countries like Zimbabwe, Malawi, Kenya, and even in South Africa. Particularly the three countries, Malawi, Zimbabwe, and Kenya, for us to still pursue our advocacy campaign for the benefit of the children.
Let me actually ask a question of Mr. Howland, based on something he said to me before we started about the relative strength and numbers of NGOs at this conference and the relative paucity of parliamentary representation. Why do you think that is, and how do you feel about it? Not to give you too big an opening.
Briefly, in relation to what's been said already, all good parliamentarians want to comment on what others have said. I fully empathize with the minister when she says that sometimes NGOs, civil society, can be a pain in the butt because they can, by necessity, always want more. I was brought up in a trade union household, and the basic principle of trade unionism is whatever is on the table, we want more. And I remember as Minister for Health announcing a £30 million child-focused programme, which I thought was a big deal on the day, and the main children's advocacy group denounced it because they said it should have been a £100 million programme. And I understood from their perspective, but it's when you fought within Cabinet to get a chunk of money, we're all human and we like to have that. There's also another point in terms of sometimes you have NGOs vying with one another to be more assertive. And one of the problems is, the old adage, the meek will inherit the earth, often the loudest voice gets political ear and funding. And important issues that don't have strong NGO bases sometimes don't get the clout that they are required. I just wanted to make that point because I think the idea of joined up thinking and fairness is also part of it. In terms of parliamentary participation in a forum like this, I believe it's important because I'm a passionate parliamentarian, because I believe that gives democratic legitimacy to actions. And I understand the use of the courts, and obviously in all our jurisdictions, that is often a resort, that you go to the courts to vindicate a particular right or to look for a particular program. But why aren't you lobbying your parliamentary colleagues, all parties, raising the issue? Do you, as a matter of routine, demand access to Parliament? Stand outside Parliament if they don't give you that access and say, this is what you must do. And mobilize, as NGOs can, the most potent force in any country, which is the electorate, to shape the views and the policies of parliamentarians.
Thanks. Dr. Kibuneka, I think in your and Maxwell's intros, Maxwell styled himself a little bit as the watchdog and you as the partnership builder. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, and particularly where have you been successful and where have you been more challenged?
Thank you. I'll begin by saying that what we've come to realize in Uganda and also in TASO is that government has certain weaknesses and also certain strengths, and also the same with TASO. So this is how this is how we. So this is how through regular meetings that have we hold between government and TASO, and also at the district level, we realized that that it is actually in our interests, both in the interests of the government and also in the interest of TASO, to work, especially in issues of PMTCT and issues in rural areas, issues of children, and so that has come to evolve, and again, on the other hand, TASO has also realized that that it's better to operate in a certain manner, so though sometimes we get criticism from the government that why are you doing this and why are you doing this now, you should stick to this and you should not get involved in this, but essentially the issue of partnership is something that is coming into play, especially as we are seeing that we are not really managing HIV in children, or even the whole HIV epidemic very well. So we've by necessity realized that it's better we work together. Thank you.
Thanks. I think that's a point that everyone around the table would agree to. I think at this point you probably have a taste of the perspective of each of the people up here, except perhaps Paul. At this point, maybe we could open the discussion up to involve some of the people who are here, because we have, I can see, even beyond the glare here, there are some very experienced people. So please, let's...
I want to say something about Parliament a little bit.
Okay, wait.
Why we don't have Parliament?
Let's have these people get it out of their systems first.
I was just wanted to mention that we are at the point in Africa where, you know, democracy is still a notion that is still very difficult to grasp. And we have all kinds of problems, and parliamentarians too need to be empowered. They need to be taught more about all these issues. I was very excited actually a month ago when I was summoned actually to one of HIV/AIDS Committee of Parliament to tell them more about the policies. And then at the end of it, then they just announced that, oh, we just told the, you know, Public Accounts Committee that you should be called to account for the, you know, we have had a Know Your Status campaign where we were testing everybody above the age of 12 years to go and account for the Know Your Status campaign funding, and honestly to tell us exactly what it is that you did with so much money. We know it belonged to partners, but you need to account. I was very excited to learn about that. But unfortunately, as he mentioned, you find situations where it takes months just to pass the budget. Just, you know, I'm talking of Malawi because I know that is a fact, and I think the minister wanted to come, but he can't come because the government, the parliament is paralyzed. So what you need to do now is, because it's a minority, they need to sit down, talk, agree, and so once this whole process, first of all, we had to go for elections in Africa after many, many years. After elections, this whole issue of handing over to successive people who have won elections is kind of, it's new. So we expect our partners, our friends, countries from the north to come to Africa, assist the parliamentarians to be empowered, to be able to see beyond being elected and beyond being a parliamentarian. That is very, very important. Once we have passed that threshold, that it will be easy. It will take a few more years, but they need to be the decision makers and policy makers.
Did I hear a bit of rumbling over here?
It's a little bit like, make me a Democrat, but not yet. I think that the organization I'm a member of was established 25 years ago as an anti-apartheid parliamentary group in Europe, basically to counter the argument then being put out by the apartheid regime that sanctions hurt black Africans. And they were being very effective in that argument. And AWEPA was established as a parliamentary group of people who were involved in the anti-apartheid campaign to link up and countervailed that argument successfully. At the end of the apartheid regime, we were asked by largely the SADC countries, frontline states as we knew them then, to continue in operation as a parliamentary support, and that's what we've been doing for the last 25 years. There's a huge democratic base across Africa, and I don't think, you know, I've been in many African parliaments where there is competent, efficient, democratic structures working well. I was in Uganda earlier this year. They have a very dynamic parliament. They have good public accounts committees. They have independent judiciary. So I am confident of Africa being able to do the parliamentary process. And of course there are problems. We were in Kenya when we saw the aftermath of the Kenyan elections, and they came up with a novel solution. I think they made 96 ministers so that every region and every political view is represented in the government. It's one novel solution, but let me tell you, it's not so awful. I come from Ireland, and we have a novel solution to Northern Ireland, where we have a power-sharing executive drawn from all political parties. So, you know, there are different structures work, and different, and there's no one model of democracy that is transposed everywhere because of tradition and ethnicity and tribalism. And I know about tribalism. I'm from Ireland. What I'm saying is that, in essence, we have to strive to empower people's democratic right to elect people and to have their vote validly interpreted, and then to empower the parliamentarian. Not to say, well, I'm elected now, the government runs the country, but the basic job I have to hold them to account is somehow to be mitigated. I don't accept that. So that's my basic thesis.
Great. So we've heard from the ministry and the parliament. Would civil society like a last word?
Yes, of course. what concerns me most, when you are dealing with parliament, you're talking about a process which should actually that process would either sacrifice the interests of the children. Now you're looking at the child who need medicine tomorrow, not the next year. Now you have to follow a strategy which will give the child medicine that particular day, not to wait for that democratic process, which usually will take quite a long, long time to deal with.
So civil society had a non-democratic last word, just to be prolonged. Okay, now people around had some questions. The woman here, and then Stuart, and then John.
It's just for recording, I think. It doesn't amplify much.
It's actually on the same subject of parliaments and looking at children's parliaments. I think that often people forget that children are the strongest advocates for themselves, and whether a WEPA and your experience has been with children's parliaments and also maybe the other panel, and kind of how we can really maximise the advocacy impact for children for themselves.
Very briefly, it's not something that a WEPA, qua a WEPA, have done, but certainly within Ireland we've done it. And the parliamentary commission that I'm a member of, looking at the rights of the child in the constitution, had a meeting with the what we call Dáil na n-Óg in the Irish language, the Youth Parliament of Ireland, which is a formal structure. And they held a questionnaire across every county of Ireland, coming up with the issues that are important to them. So certainly, structurally, there is a consultative role for young people and for children in their own welfare, and it is something that we should probably take up on an AWEPA basis.
Let me just welcome Paul Zeitz from Global AIDS Alliance, and let him know that what we've done is kind of say what our organizations do, how we see the complementarity of government, which has been split between ministry and parliament now, distinguished, I should say. And
honorable, even.
That's right. and civil society. And basically, we'll take a couple of questions, and you can think how you want to jump in then. So, Stuart?
And
identify yourself.
Stuart Keane. I work with. Sorry. Yeah. I'm Stuart Keane. I work with World Vision International. My question is, I suppose, to the minister and the former minister, but to try and get at the issue of policy influence, what is it that and I sense speak as an advocate to try and find out what's going to influence you. Is, to what extent is it the fact that we could get constituents, members of the public, being able to make a case about children that's going to influence you? To what extent is it lobbying that's going to come from NGOs? To what extent is it actually research and evidence that you need to have? So what is it that's going to really enable you in your roles as ministers to bring about policy change and more effectively policy implementation?
I would say all the issues that you mentioned would actually influence me. It depends on whether, I mean, if it's evidence-based, whatever it is that I have to do on behalf of the children, I would actually embrace it. But just to give you a little bit, before a law is passed on behalf of the children or behalf of anyone, we have to workshop it. All interest groups will have to come around and have a say, even in the writing, even in the language, how it looks like. Of course, we still follow the Westminster style. I mean, it still has to conform to that kind of, because we have a Westminster style parliament, so the language of bills is pretty much the same. But whether it is lobbying or whether it is evidence-based, you know, I mean science-based, I embrace all that. So it is not very difficult. I'm a very accessible person. So all NGOs, no, seriously, I am. She's laughing at the back. Very accessible, even as a minister. It's a very small country, you know. People can walk in and get to meet me. You're invited to come. You'll see I am accessible. So on behalf of the children, really, there's very little that any of us would stay unmoved. We are quite moved by issues and we are quite appalled by the fact that we've done so little for our children.
Well, I can only answer the question in the Irish context, and my first, I suppose, answer is to belie everything I've just said in terms of the people being, you know, the attitude of the people being paramount, because I think a compelling argument of evidence, if I think it's right, I'll vote for that and I will advocate that, even if it's not popular. As you can see, that's a view taken by a lot of Irish parliamentarians. The Irish Parliament voted for the Lisbon Treaty by 160 for and 6 against. The referendum, the people voted against it. So there was a certain disconnect between Parliament and people on that important issue, and I dare say on other ones too, because sometimes Parliament needs to lead as well as to follow. On initiatives occasionally in the past, I think courageous politicians pathfind rather than wait for the wind of the people to follow. But it's a call you have to make. But certainly, if there is strong advocacy and strong lobbying, it impacts on politicians and the way they formulate and their attitude to policy.
And probably those pathfinders could also use a couple of informed advocates. John.
I'm John Miller from the Coalition on Children Affected by AIDS, and I've at times been an AIDS activist, and then I've also been in the civil service in Canada. And so I know that sometimes the shouting of civil society can be a nuisance, but it can also sometimes be used by politicians and by civil servants who are trying to convince their colleagues because they happen to be in agreement with the shouting. So I just wanted to ask the two parliamentarians if you could give instances of when it's useful to have press, civil society give public declarations or to have demonstrations, and when it isn't useful to you.
Well, I'll give a recent occurrence. We noticed that we had a lot of anecdotal data about children leaving the country, who were adopted, and some of them were adopted illegally and being sent to go into all sorts of things, whether they were being sex slaves or whether they were being traded, and you know. So we talked about it amongst people who were interested, and of course encouraged civil society to push me to actually suspend adoptions in the country and institute a commission of inquiry led by a judge. That happened. I needed them to be just outside shouting for 30 minutes, and I stopped it. So that's the kind of, when it is for a good cause, I think I would do that. I don't quite like it when they put me in the spot. When they put me in the spot, then I don't like it. I mean, like when they, for instance, there were, you know, a lot of South African-based organizations that did not want the opt-out method as was done in Lesotho, when we were just, I mean, we just quietly instituted opt-out in all hospitals, all clinics, everywhere. Walked in, we made absolutely no noise about it. And a year later, then they were saying that we are violating people's human rights. There were demonstrations. I would have none of it, absolutely. Fortunately, at that time, I was not a politician, but I actually encouraged politicians to just totally ignore it, because people were dying. So I don't think civil society was used well in that. You know, the demonstrations worked for them at that point in time, because they were saying that people are not being given proper counseling, people are not being, their rights were being violated, people were traumatized by the fact that they now knew their status. You know what? I don't think so. Their lives were saved, in my view. So I if it's for a good, I mean, the civil society, you can use it. It depends. You know, they follow whoever sometimes has the most money or the biggest voice. You know very well that is what happens, you know. So it is difficult in the age of HIV and AIDS. We are a landlocked country, unfortunately landlocked by one country. And our people looked to South Africa as a panacea of everything. They know everything. The best comes out of South Africa. But when it comes to HIV and AIDS, I think they have now noticed. No, it's absolutely the opposite. So I would love very much to have our people demonstrating in South Africa for the good causes there.
Very good. Would you like to add to it?
Well, I'll give you two. You asked for two examples in my own experience where advocacy or campaigning was a help. One was when I was Minister for Health in relation to AIDS campaigning. I've come from a very conservative country, and to have, as I determined, a very in-your-face television advertising campaign promoting condoms and changing the law in relation to the availability of condoms at the same time, to have very strong voices, particularly people affected by AIDS, being vocal about the issue was a huge assistance, probably an essential assistance. And parliamentary support was important. And I also was Minister for the Environment, and certainly the climate change issue, where you had to make difficult decisions, was helped by lobby groups in relation to that matter. Where it's of detriment, there are some very loud voices from the NGO community that I simply don't agree with. Some very conservative voices, as you can imagine, in my country, that I profoundly disagree with, and I'm willing to argue with them. So, you know, advocacy comes from all shapes and sizes, and things that from the podium are said as unchallenged truth, for example, that circumcision is an assistance in the prevention of sexual disease transmission. There's a guy down there saying the opposite. That's an NGO and an advocacy that I wouldn't agree with. So there's all shapes and sizes, if you'll pardon the phrase, in terms of arguing all positions. Some you agree with, some you disagree with.
Great. Now, before we take a couple more questions, I'd like to give Paul an opportunity to jump in.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks, everyone. Sorry for being late. I was jumping through traffic, literally. I said, taxi, drop me here, and I leaped through a few lanes to get here as quickly as I did. My name is Paul Zeitz. I'm the Executive Director of the Global AIDS Alliance, and I'm also on the Board of Directors of Global Action for Children. These are two U.S.-based political advocacy organizations that are dedicated to accelerating bold action now in order to achieve results on behalf of children and on behalf of mitigating the end of the global AIDS pandemic. And, you know, we're part of, transnational advocacy movements. So we work in solidarity with partners in implementing countries and in solidarity with advocacy partners in donor countries. And I think that's, I'm here in the midst of this AIDS conference looking at the power of the transnational AIDS movement. This meeting is a biannual ritual where we all sort of come together and see each other and feel out where the movement is moving. And this is my fifth in a row, so I have that ability to reflect on it that way. And after the Children and AIDS Summit that we had earlier last week, I was thinking, where is the global children's conference, where we're struggling with science and political action and implementation strategies and all the medley of what's going on here in order to achieve children's well-being in the world? It's really missing. And I think that we're struck by the profound weakness and lack of connectivity between very dynamic children's advocates in each and every country that I am aware of. You know, Petronella from Justice for Children in Zimbabwe and the Uganda Child Rights Network and CHIN in Zambia. I mean, all these groups are there, ready to roll, and they have no resources, and the donors are not giving them any money, and there's no voice for children, literally. It's very, very weak. And that's why we see this ongoing crisis of children. And we had a fight to get children even recognized at this conference. It's unbelievable. So I think that people are studying the AIDS movement, and I think people are recognizing that there's some things that we've learned how to do that maybe could be replicated for other issue areas. The one thing that we've done is UNAIDS in 2001 at the UNGAS did a global costing. We said it's going to achieve $10 billion a year to achieve universal access. And then we said, Uncle Sam and Aunt Samantha in Washington, you owe one-third of that. That's $3 billion. Okay? And then countries have to pay their fair share, and all the donors have to pay their fair share. If we don't know what it costs to achieve the goal we want to achieve, we can never get there. So we think it costs $10 billion a year to achieve children's well-being. You know, but UNICEF, we can't get them to do a global costing on what it would take. It's strange. The AIDS movement then works on advancing specific policy issues. We work on getting the money, and then we work on breaking through the policy barriers. The biggest barrier right now facing AIDS is the fiscal space constraints that are imposed on countries by the IMF and the World Bank that prevent expenditure for human resources in the health sector, education sector, and social protection sector. There's a philosophical battle going on at the global level between that construct of reality, fiscal space constraints, and the need to provide health care for all people. I mean, that's really the debate. So there's those kinds of debates in education and on social protection as well. We're running around Washington saying we could get every kid in school for $10 billion a year based on DFID's estimate. That's 3 weeks of the Iraq War just from the U.S. expenditures. For 3 weeks of the Iraq War, we could get every kid in school in 5 years. I mean, what is wrong with us as people on the planet? Why can't we make that happen? And so we're about urgency, we're about fierce determination, we're about relentless pursuit of justice, and we use every tactic. We want politicians to feel uncomfortable. We want you to feel awkward in your skin. You're not supposed to be cozy. You're supposed to be on the front line of ideas. And politics is the competition of ideas. And, you know, we need you to advance the idea of solving the problems, and your civil society has to hold politicians accountable. Thank you.
Welcome, Paul. Would you like to respond?
I'd like to respond to Paul. Paul, you know, you've just changed the whole debate now. We were on top with the fellow parliamentarian here. Our civil society is in the majority.
The people speak.
I know. You know, when you talk of the fact that we really do not even know the financial architecture of HIV and AIDS, it's disgraceful. I was in 4 hours sitting in a meeting talking about financial architecture with the World Bank, UNAIDS, WHO, PEPFAR, Ambassador Diable, and Michelle Kazatchkin. We were all there sitting and talking about, and what did we reach? Nothing. Nothing. We do not know, nobody knows the financial architecture of HIV and AIDS. But we have policies such as the one you have mentioned of that, or where that human, we cannot even employ the human resources that we produce. Right now, as we speak, Kenya is producing more nurses than any other country in Africa. And 3/4 of those nurses are at home or are working out somewhere. As a result, we had to actually get funding from the Parliament of Ireland to fund us to get the nurses from Kenya to come and work in Lesotho. Why? Because 3/4 of the nurses from Lesotho are working in the UK and Australia. So, you know, it is really very complicated. We don't have a voice sometimes in Africa or in the developing world, and I agree with you entirely. Until such time that we know the financial architecture of HIV and AIDS, as it is now, how it is compromised, and the amount of money that actually is needed, hopefully we'll be able to treat HIV and AIDS. But right now, it is very difficult. There are countries who are not coming to the party. There are countries in Europe which are not coming to the party at all. And so, well, you know, should we be excited about the recent announcement by Ambassador Diable of PEPFAR? Should we be?
It's a rhetorical question.
Yeah.
You want my opinion?
I think we have it.
No, I mean, I think we worked in relentlessly on that. I think that the PEPFAR initiative is a historic breakthrough.
It's recording. It doesn't actually.
That's fine. Okay. Okay. Hello. Okay. Okay. Oh, for recording. Yes, I can whisper. The PEPFAR bill we think is a historic breakthrough in terms of the level of investment, $48 billion over 5 years. It's the largest investment in human history. We think that it needs to be fixed, though, and we need to work together to fix it. At least half of the U.S. assistance is spent in my city, Washington, D.C., on overhead rates and technical assistance, and it's called Tide Aid. You know, they required the Buy America clause. And the exciting news is that the Congress, both the House and the Senate, have foreign aid reform as the top of the agenda. And we need stakeholders like yourselves from other donor countries and from implementing countries to step forward and say, how do you think the U.S. should do business going forward? And depending on the outcome of the election, there's a good prospect that there could be a new Department of Global Development. A new cabinet-level department is being contemplated in the political arena and by the presidential candidates. Now, we don't know what they actually would do, but it's in play right now. And so I think it's really recipient countries pushing the U.S. to change its behavior and, you know, give the money to programs and indigenous organizations and local governments in order to make the money work to achieve results. So I think there's a lot of opportunities for fixing the way the U.S. does business, and let's seize this political transition that's coming up and optimize that.
Jane, you can ask your question if you want.
Okay. Will you use the mic?
Are you sure?
Sure, please. Come on. After all your work on plans of action.
Well, yeah, my burning question actually is that a lot of work has gone into the National Orphan and Vulnerable Children Strategic Plans. And to varying degrees, there was civil society participation, and to varying degrees, including child and caregiver participation as part of civil society. And 19 of these have been ratified by government. The bottom lines on these strategies in terms of resources needed are very large. They're somewhere between $30 and $50 million for each year of a 3 to 5 year plan, approximately. So my question is this, and it's really to the civil society folks. So in a resource-poor setting or in a resource-limited setting where only some of the monies are trickling from governments and from donors in support of these very in-depth planned strategies, what are your wishes for how civil society can continue to be involved in setting priorities, given that there are limited resources and not everything can be attended to perhaps in the first year or second year, and then in implementation? Because we've been talking a lot about just getting people around the table to make OVC a priority, but in those countries where there is some kind of prioritization of OVC, how can civil society continue to work as true partners with government, you know, in each stage of implementation and evaluation of these plans? I'd love to hear from civil society about that in particular.
Who wants the mic?
It's quite an interesting question, particularly that it's very clear in terms of the thinking of the government and also maybe I would say international partners in how they could solve some of the problems which affect the grassroots. Why, if the consultation would originate from the grassroots themselves and the civil society, the thinking might be slightly different. The civil society mostly would want to engage, because the civil society strongly believes that within the local settings, within the communities, there's quite a lot of resources. And it's not all the time that you might need an international partner to help out in terms of solving out problems surrounding communities. So by engaging more civil society, to engage more in terms of mobilizing communities to find solution to the problem which they face, maybe that could be the first solution. But currently, what we have noticed is that the civil society organizations have weak capacity. They cannot manage really to engage the community as much as they could have wished because of their weak capacity. So the first thing perhaps maybe for me would be to build up the capacity of civil society so that they are able at least to mobilize the communities to be able to solve out some of the small problems within the community. Before that, also engage the civil society to facilitate the process where, you know, they are involved at all stages of implementation of policies.
Thank you. My comments to this, first of all, is that funding is also a very complex issue, and it keeps changing. For example, in Uganda, the civil organizations are now being funded for HIV through something called the Civil Society Fund, and so things are changing. However, having said that, also that TASO is a large NGO which has a budget. It's a donor-funded NGO and which has a budget larger than many ministries in Uganda. But what I think regarding OVCs is that we've had problems in not prioritizing as an organization OVC issues. And so this has also brought up the amount of money that comes in for the OVC program has somehow been limited. What has happened was that when we get funds, that it is somehow funds are not earmarked for OVCs. And so it has become an issue. It has taken us back to the drawing table to try and work out our OVC strategy, looking at the national OVC strategy plan and so on. So those are some of the dilemmas we've been going through.
My response is that the reason why those plans haven't been funded is because there's no transnational advocacy behind getting those plans supported. $50 million plans in 20 countries is about $1 billion. Okay, that there is you need $1 billion a year for those plans. There's about a $35 trillion annual global economy, so there's plenty of money around to support the implementation of those plans. But there's no groups in these countries holding their own governments accountable to get the money to fund those plans. And there's no global solidarity behind that. So that if the president of country X is coming to London or coming to Washington, there's no protest against that president when he's or she are coming through the global capitals. I can tell you from personal experience that those presidents are very sensitive to the U.S. press that they get. So we've done, you know, we can do those kinds of actions. Media work, holding them accountable. Everywhere they go, they get held accountable. There's just no movement trying to make it happen. And that's a rounding error on the global economy. There's just no political will to do what is a basic right. And we are just completely failing as global stakeholders in generating the political will. It's not, we know how to do it. We know how to generate will. But it's not happening.
Just, it's the same argument again. What you're saying to parliamentarians and to governments as well is that you know how the money is to be spent, but there are organizations for the aged or for a million other issues that says, well, this is the way the money should be spent. So it's not a matter of saying, I know, and we will screw somebody who doesn't agree with us. You have to convince. And convince is not standing and beating up. It is going to parliaments, either in African countries, and saying the policy is wrong here, and we have to change it and make that case. And go to the parliaments of the donor countries to say, listen, the money has been misspent. Do something about it. And that's why my thesis again is the pivotal role of the connection of parliament as the democratic tier to do it. Because I don't think that any NGO, no matter how powerful, can say, this is what you must do because I say so. And who are you? And what's your legitimacy? You have to have the legitimacy of the vote of the people, ultimately, to speak authoritatively.
Great. Zanle, you had a question?
Whether it's on policy or implementation, to say this policy is wrong and be able to get a response and engage in a process to address those issues, or if it is on funding, to say these are the wrong priorities where the funding is going, do you feel as civil society that you have the space to engage either on policy, on resource allocation, or implementation? Or do you think this is an area that still civil society still needs to develop the capacity to do?
Thank you for that question. I just want to say that sometimes as a civil society, TASO has taken steps and pointed out certain issues to the policymakers, which is the government. Just to bring you back on board, our former executive director who gave the plenary on Monday, Dr. Alex Cotino, about 3 months ago, there was a Uganda hasn't adopted male circumcision, but this is something that was brought out in the open. So so you see that there have been steps, from civil society regarding certain issues, pointing out that this is the direction that should be taken. Thank you.
I would say that advocacy is a continuous process. The moment the civil society sleep, it means that the government will relax. and it means that the one who to suffer now will be the beneficiaries. But if the civil society would engage themselves in a continuous process, it means that you would actually see the benefits from that process. But I do agree with you that maybe this is something which the civil society need to strengthen in terms of capacity building. There are not so many organizations, but who are those who are working with the children, who have got expertise in terms of advocacy. And at the same time, mostly, they would engage the government at the grassroots level, but not at the policy level. So it's something which we really need to transform ourselves as a civil society organization, working with the children, to be able to interact with the to have more interaction with the government at the policy level.
Thanks. I'm thinking, just judging from the temperature of the room and a bit of the body English, should we take one or two more questions and then ask each of the participants to kind of give a summing up? Mulugeta, you'd like a question? Okay.
Sorry.
Well, actually, in Africa, actually, we don't have really much experience in working with research institutions, with academia, with universities, to have concrete data so that, we can bring that issue to the government to convince for a policy change. I think that is one of the problems, and there is no strong networking. And if you go to, like, in Europe, for example, like in Ireland or in UK, the civil society strongly work with these institutions. I think that needs to happen in Africa also, so that, we can have a concrete data to bring it to the attention of the government so that we can influence the policy. Otherwise, I think individual NGOs, I don't think we can really go further. Even among the NGO community, we need really a strong voice. We need a strong networking. So I think that is very important in Africa. Thank you.
My name is Desiree. I work with NOAA, Nurturing Orphans of AIDS for Humanity in South Africa. I was hoping that the minister from Lesotho would be here. I think she went to the toilet. So I don't know. I guess I can open it still up to everybody, but in part, it's specific in part to the South African context, but I think it's applicable across the region with regards to OVC. In South Africa at the moment, there's quite a few bills, particularly the Children's Act bill that's going forward, and it does specifically address lots of the issues of OVC. So I guess let's take it from the civil society portion and the government sector. There's quite a few elements to it that assume that there are going to be enough social workers and enough people on the ground that are going to be able to implement. So on one level, we see that the government is taking action, and we applaud that. But on the same side, on the ground, you know that there's not necessarily X number of social workers to actually be able to get the birth certificates available for all the students or for all the children. So I know that you were mentioning before that sometimes, pilot will take action hoping that civil society and everybody else will follow. So I guess the question would be, I was in part hoping to get the perspective from Lesotho, but maybe to open it up to the other parts as well. I don't know what all the things that are happening in some of the other parts of the region, but perhaps perspective as well. Say, from the government side, in this situation where there's not necessarily enough infrastructure, do we move forward? Is this a good push to move forward with the government? Or from the civil society point, do we say, well, wait a second, we wanted the government involvement, but at the same time, we need these resources on the ground first. Does that make sense?
My direct answer to you is that I think that enacting good law is a good thing, even if the resources to implement it immediately are not there. And that happens in developed countries as well as developing countries. Because once you have enacted a law, then you can press for its implementation. If it's not enacted, you will never get to the point where there is adequate resources, because what is adequate? As Minister for Health in Ireland, enacted the Children's Act, which had been passed by Parliament 2 years previously, but only sections of it had been brought into effect because of resource matters. But eventually, you can face the lobbying of civil society to say, listen, Parliament has spoken, bring in the resources. So my strong view would be get Parliament to enact best practice rather than sit on their hands until resources may become available.
Briefly, I do agree with that comment. We should understand that civil society organization, apart from looking at ensuring that the government provide the its necessary or implement its responsibility in terms of putting in place policies, programs, and laws, civil society has to also to come in. Knowing with the current setting, economic settings within our countries, civil society has to come in as, again, to complement the government effort in terms of providing services. Otherwise, what will be happening is that the target audience, the children, will actually lose trust in us. They will think that we're only there to lobby the government to put in place the laws. At the same time, because of the economic challenges which are within our countries, if the government fails, then what happens is that that particular law will also have a negative effect on the target audience. So the civil society organization have that responsibility of pushing on the government and at the same time also complement the government effort in terms of providing the services.
If you'll permit, I think what I would like to do now is to ask each of the participants to give something of a closing statement, and then if some of you want to either challenge or stay behind afterward and talk, there'll certainly be room, but it does take us a while to get back to our hotels, I noticed last night. What I would like the people up here, the talk show guests, to think about is the speech of Stephen Lewis at the end of the pre-conference symposium on children affected by AIDS. He was very articulate and very condemning, I think, of basically the way things are slipping in terms of the 2010 goal for universal access. And I think he fired us up a bit about what can actually be done between now and 2010. And I'd just like to hear from each of you, what would you like to see in this conference or in any other venue that you cherish in the year 2010 in terms of better delivery for children and in terms of the complementarity of civil society, of parliament, and of ministries? You certainly... No.
I'm sorry.
No, please.
Connie
from UNICEF.
Yeah. Sure, good. My name's Corinne Woods. I'm from UNICEF. And the question that I have for each of the panel members is this. Well, it's two parts. One, UNICEF, and Paul has already articulated what UNICEF could be doing, and we're hearing very loud lobbying to UNICEF on what we could be doing about some costing. But in that UNICEF has a normative role and should be doing a watchdog role, what do civil society organisations believe we could be doing more to support their work? What should we be doing in terms of work with government? What should we be doing work with civil society organisations in the north? And where could we play a better role on the advocacy part as opposed to the implementation? The second part of the question, and I'm sorry to have two questions when you wanted to wrap up, but... it's really a question about this. I spent 5 years in India in a very interesting policy environment, beautiful policies, very weak implementation. So there was always a struggle. So I think the point about get the policies, but it's the advocacy around implementation that really makes the difference. But one of the big mantras in India was India moves India. International discourse, international, will not help and actually will damage. Now, that's an interesting question because sometimes international spotlight actually help move things. But I'd just be interested to know, at what point does international actually have a negative impact because it is the country that moves the country, not the international organizations and so on and so forth. So I'd just be interested in that sort of perception. And I'm sorry to ask questions right at the end.
Both very appropriate questions, I think. Shall we start actually with the second? Ask, I think, our one governmental implementing country representative here about international, and then ask the group about UNICEF.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is that the international organizations are the ones that actually try and move the government to implement or to change policy. Was that what you were trying to say?
Does it backfire?
I agree. Yeah, it can be good and it can be bad also. Even if the governments are very weak, then international organizations then just take over. That's what happens. Either they are weak in implementation or lack the will to actually implement. Because the country that you mentioned should have resources. It should have at least human resources to be able to implement. We in Lesotho question, I think, pretty much everything. We have everything. We have asked our international partners to work within the government structure. This is why when you get to Lesotho and you ask for any organizations, that if it is related to the government, to the Ministry of Health, it will be in the Ministry of Health. So that we work alongside these partners. So also, it is very difficult to have organizations such as TASO, that the one here in Lesotho, that organization wouldn't be implementing at such a level. It would be part of the government, or implementing on behalf of the government. So I don't think it's sustainable to have, you need to have government ownership. You need to have country ownership of programs and processes. So I think something was wrong there somewhere. Somebody lacked the will to actually work well with the implementing partners, because they will take over. They are very, very fast in taking over and determining policy.
So the backfiring starts
when ownership? When you take ownership. You asked, I think, a question about this organization. What are we taking from here? What should such fora such as this one be doing?
We had a question about UNICEF first. About.
I think UNICEF is actually one the champion of children. Its advocacy role is very, very important on behalf of the of children, but sometimes UNICEF is an implementing. So they have this is one organization that can be very, very good, and also they tend to implement as well. I think they also have that implementing arm of UNICEF. This is the one that governments do not like. This, I have to be honest with you, we do not like when UNICEF implements, because they go along, it depends who is in the country and what their feeling is about what they have to do. And I made an example of when UNICEF wanted to give assistance to young mothers. In Lesotho, young mothers are educated most of the time, I mean, literacy rate is high, and they give them farm implements in Maseru, Lesotho, where there are no farms. So to go and grow vegetables, and it was a big laugh. You know, they laughed so much. They were wondering what is going on here. What are we supposed to farm? We live in apartments. We don't even have plots. So what I'm saying is, when it does implement, we have to work together with governments, and because the other roles of UNICEF, I have only praises.
Others who would like to speak to the question about UNICEF?
Yes.
Briefly, I would say that UNICEF really need to engage more the civil society organization in terms of in order for them to be able to empower the grassroots to demand for their rights, and in so doing, I think the civil society could be able to transform. Or maybe to cover up where the government might have some shortfalls. So to me, I think one of the most important things which UNICEF can do is the engagement of civil society to be able to empower the grassroots. Otherwise, if you don't do that, then you're creating a quick civil society. Eventually, the grassroots will be the one to suffer.
And if the host can permit himself a slightly partisan response, UNICEF is fundamental and the global response to children at any level, but also for children and AIDS. And I think the idea of a campaign or a collective push has been very useful and mobilizing of people. But there is a structural contradiction. that UNICEF needs to deal with, and that is that it's also a cash mobilizer for UNICEF as an organization. And those of us on the outside watch the internal machinations over that with some dismay, because we need you to bring us all together. And we need the people who are program-driven to take the lead on that, because the cash will come in, you know. And I know you know that, but I think it's useful to put it on record.
Can I make a brief
Sure.
comment?
Go ahead.
Just in answer to your two questions. First question, I think it's a very real one. That is, how impactive is external pressure? Or, in fact, can it actually be a negative force? And that's why, in terms of the organization I work with, the idea is to have peer pressure through the regional parliaments within Africa or through the Pan-African Parliament, for them to set the standards and them to be the watchdogs, and for European parliaments to simply support that and give that capacity. And I think there's certainly no way that any African parliament or parliamentarian is going to take direction from European parliaments. But there are, I mean, I had the great privilege of going to Uganda to argue against the change of the constitution to give Museveni a third term, and a very good debate within parliament. They allowed that level of access because we have that working relationship, which can have an impact. I'm interested about your experience in India. Well, India, I think, is a law unto itself. I was in the Indian Parliament on a formal, I led a formal delegation there in Easter of this year, and I put a question to the chairman of the Human Rights Parliamentary Commission about their laws against homosexuality, and she told me that there was no homosexuality in India, which is a cultural issue, and that was that. There's no argument if that's the view. In relation to the work of UNICEF within the North or within Ireland, interesting, the new UNICEF representative in Ireland is the former South African ambassador to Ireland, Melanie Vervoet, who has decided to stay and become the UNICEF person there. So we certainly, at parliamentary level, have a good working relationship with her, and I'm looking forward to certainly working with her through the organization we have to strengthen our cooperation with UNICEF, which already is very good.
Thank you. Are there other questions that people did want to get to?
At the hand of the back.
Oh, Katie.
Can I just speak like
this? It's not the hearing, it's the recording for posterity.
That's what I noticed.
My name is Katie Vauda. I'm from the Children's Rights Center in Durban and a Firelight Advisory Board member as well. Okay, see, now I've got a mic in front of me. I expected to do all the work. And maybe that's a metaphor for UNICEF as well. I wanted to go back to the point that was sort of a couple of questions back, and that was that by having in legislation things that need to be done and not having the resources at the time, there is a legal obligation. And it wasn't a mistake, it wasn't an oversight that there weren't enough social, there have never been enough social workers, whether we put it in law or not. But it actually allows us to then go back to Parliament and say, this is the law you passed, what is your plan for pressuring government to make sure, and what can civil society do to assist in that? So I think that it was very deliberate in the Children's Act and the Children's Amendment Act to make sure that all those categories of workers that are required to not have NGOs, either unpaid or unacknowledged, fulfilling those roles, are in fact now either integrated into government service, adequately remunerated for what they do, and that we have a skills and a human resources plan for children, which we have not yet had. Can I speak to the other point, the UNICEF point, or is that just for the panel? If I speak now? Okay. So I can speak now. That's the first time. Usually it's if I speak quietly. I just wanted to say I think there's a real tension internationally, but I know certainly within South Africa around UNICEF, because UNICEF signs bilateral agreements with governments. And if you're a civil society advocate, that means you have to rub government up the wrong way sometimes. And so civil society finds UNICEF a very fickle and a very undermining partner. So as much as we want UNICEF to play that role, in fact, you've got an inherent contradiction in how you're set up. And I think that for civil society, for instance, we tried, I'll give a specific example, in South Africa, we pulled UNICEF South Africa in to the Unite for Children, Unite Against AIDS campaign. We saw the logo, we saw nothing was happening, we developed things, and it stopped at a pamphlet. You know, and it was just, there was the, it stopped at a pamphlet, and but for UNICEF, in terms of their M&E and their indicators, and they consider it a very good partnership. Civil society looks at it and says, sorry, but that's not what for us. And I think with government as well, learning how to work together is something that within South Africa, we've really worked hard and had some really quite bloody noses along the way sometimes, literally, in terms of trying to get a way of working together that allows each role player to play their role, but to have a respect. And I think civil society often gets trampled in that, which is, I think, the point that Maxwell keeps coming back to. So that was.
I was going to comment about UNICEF, too, and I think it was a similar thing. I mean, UNICEF is an intergovernmental body at the global by its governance. And so it's beholden to the wishes of governments. I know UNICEF is a great advocate and great partner of civil society, and I think in this role of, or this question of how do we build civil society advocacy movements, I think there's a real question about whether or not UNICEF should be the one to channel money to those independent civil society groups, or should they facilitate private foundations to channel that money so that those advocates can be truth-sayers and be voices of justice, as opposed to be beholden to that construct that was described in South Africa, because that's around the world. So I think that's a real fundamental question. I think the other big question is UN reform. I mean, the role of the UN is a really fundamental question going on right now. And how will UNICEF relate to its other partners? I think I'm curious to learn more about how that's being implemented, how the one UN system movement is actually happening or not. UNICEF was one of the most effective agencies, so we wouldn't want UN reform to hurt it, but the parallelism of the system is so dysfunctional. So I don't know how UNICEF is grappling with advancing children's issues in the context of UN reform.
That's a whole other seminar.
Yeah, I'll just go for this.
Okay. Well, at this point, why don't I ask each of the speakers to give me the 1 minute. What would you like to see happen in the next couple of years by the time we get together in Vienna? Why don't we start with you, Paul?
Like my dream?
Yeah, your feasible dream.
My feasible dream is that Barack Obama will be elected president on November 5th or whatever it is, and he is going to launch a global initiative on behalf of the world's children, and he is going to mobilize billions of dollars necessary to achieve all 8 MDGs by 2015. He's going to create a global fund for education, get every kid in school around the world in his first term.
So that's really feet on the ground sort of thing, Brendan?
I agree with that. Realistically, my concern, maybe a pretty concern as well as a hope, because I do hope that we can achieve those commitments that we are committed to, which is not asking more than I've already signed up to. My fear, and I say this from a European perspective, is that the changed economic circumstances across the world now, but certainly across most of the countries I know in Europe, are already having an impact on aid budgets, and they're already being squeezed. The Irish aid budget has already been cut this year from what it was in January by a small amount, but about 50 million pulled back, supposedly not being able to be spent this year. And that's going to happen across Europe. So I think we really need to double our efforts. And I'm saying it from a parliamentary perspective, we can do something about that, because we have to prevent our aid budgets and the targets we've set internationally from being the soft option in the next 2 years.
Okay.
Let me just say parenthetically about that, the Irish Aid has been the funder of the Joint Learning Initiative, and I believe that some of those cuts in Ireland have also impacted already on the budget of the Joint Learning Initiative. So we see it clearly.
And we're the main sponsor of the SUTU, and we also fund TASO.
Okay, so this is an important statement then.
Well, you know, what I would like to see maybe falls again outside of the realm of this particular
conversation
that we're having. I have not seen enough advocacy for children's medication. I don't see, you know, we are still using the same formulations, the same Caltrate that we need to put in fridges, yet we know that there is already Caltrate that you no longer have to put in, you know, that is heat resistant. Right? Well, there hasn't been, I don't see much about children's diagnosis, you know, young children as a complement of PMTCT. Nothing in this conference about that. Yet, without having proper diagnosis, fast proper diagnosis, and also medication, formulation that children can actually use, that mothers, that caregivers, that grandparents can use, we are not going to achieve any of the targets that we are talking about. So I don't think this, for my view, I mean, I was rather amazed that this conference, that even people who are advocating, they're advocating for housing. I've not had anybody advocating for simpler regimens to be made available for children.
Thank you. My view, first of all, I'll begin by saying that there needs still to be a lot of attention to children. Many people are still not aware of the issues involved with the children. And how I usually tell people that when I graduated in 1986, the people the children who were born at that time are adults. And it is very careful. One has to be very careful to see that children are handled properly so that they grow up. And that is what it means about the next generation. It's a very difficult concept to understand. However, and also that whenever someone goes regarding children issues, it usually comes that somehow it has either been forgotten or it's been put at the end of the agenda, whether it is at a conference or so. So this is something that that is an observation through working with children. But just that my vision for the coming years, maybe 2010, is to see better care and treatment for HIV infected and affected children. Thank you.
Very, very often I'm saddened with the amount of resources being put to the waste around the world. Yet the same resources would have made a huge difference to a child who only needed a piece of bread to survive. I strongly believe that active civil society would make active government and active society. If the civil society is sleeping, then the government will relax. Then what happens is you create a weak society. I strongly believe that in a small way, civil society organization, once they have increased or strengthened their advocacy strategies, they are cooperating, then definitely we'll be able at least to achieve the goals. And at the same time, if we renew our commitment to the children after this, the conference, no child will really suffer, no child will really die because of our initiative. If we don't do that, then all of us will be there to blame.
Thanks. I mean, if we review from left to right here, then basically, Paul was a bit hoping for the new era. I think we'll have some, but probably not as much as he asked for. Mm-hmm. Brendan was saying maintain current accountabilities and hold the line in difficult economic times. I think that's important, and that's very practical. The minister, I think, had an extremely important point that there is an agenda for advocacy and it involves children, and we need to make sure that our efforts focus on that. A similar point from Andrew and from Maxwell, the question of a strong, a robust and watchdogging civil society and adequate resources for kids. I, we know what needs to be done. I myself, I would say that I think in the pre-conference symposium and in the sessions we've had, I would agree with the minister. We should align ourselves with the agendas that are out there, and we should insist that people don't slow down on those agendas. Each of us has different roles to play, but there is a movement going on, and we should make sure that it moves forward. Thanks, everyone, for putting up with us for so long. It's late, and I know you have to get back to your hotels, but I'd also like to salute the work that all of you are doing, and I know that that was an important part and motivation for you to be here. So look forward to seeing you again in different venues, but let's move things forward. Thanks a lot.